Another poll shows Jacksonville voters don't want the Republican National Convention coming to town. Good morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, we're taking the voters' pulse on coronavirus, the RNC, Biden and Trump, and more. Join us. It's 549-2937. Then later, how you can be part of what's good all around the First Coast. We'll share the launch of our What's Good Wednesdays, both on the air and by newsletter. But first this hour, the latest on the COVID crisis by the numbers. Statewide, the Department of Health now reports 103,506 total cases and 3,237 deaths. That's an increase of 64 deaths, the largest single-day jump since June 2nd. In our area, we have 4,633 cases and 113 deaths. Now, against this backdrop of rising COVID cases around Florida, a new poll shows widespread local opposition to the Republican National Convention coming to Jacksonville this summer, as well as increased levels of concerns about coronavirus in general. We're also getting some new data on where all of you stand on who you'll vote for this November in the presidential election, where you stand on that half-cent sales tax referendum for local schools, and more. Mike Binder runs UNF's Public Opinion Research Lab, and he's on the line. Hi, Mike.
Morning. Thanks for having me, Melissa.
And here's our question to callers. Let us know how you feel about the Republican National Convention coming to town and how you're feeling about the coronavirus data we're getting. It's 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. Our Facebook page open as well. Well, your poll is the second in 2 days to take the pulse of Duval County voters on the RNC coming into this community in August, Mike. What did the polling show?
Well, unsurprisingly, it split along partisan lines. 58% of registered voters here in Duval County are opposed to it, either somewhat or strongly. 47% strongly opposed to it. But really, the divisions are partisan. 90% of Democrats are opposed. 80% of Republicans support it. But the NPAs and the others, oftentimes, you know, neglected swing voter types, 62% of those folks oppose it as well. So this is not just a Democrat-Republican issue. NPAs are not supportive either.
And is the opposition largely driven by worries about spread of the virus, or is there some concern about protests coming into the community as well?
Well, it's a little bit of both. Obviously, virus spread is a big concern. 71% of people are concerned that, you know, bringing all those folks in from across the country could, and putting them in such close quarters could increase corona risk. But also, 65% of folks are concerned about potential protests and social unrest. And, you know, in the backdrop of what's been going on the last several weeks across the country, that's a fairly legitimate concern.
Now, you also polled on job approval for Mayor Lenny Curry, who, of course, lobbied heavily to bring the RNC to Jacksonville. He's the former state chair of the Florida Republican Party. Certainly, the mayor saw this as a feather in his cap and a plus for the city. That said, you found a drop in approval for the mayor since you last polled on this, right?
Yeah, so, yes, we did. And we asked, we polled in April on COVID approval, so I didn't want to put that comparison in there because I think that's a different animal. This is just overall job approval. And last year when we asked, in the same format, again, this was an online poll of registered voters. We emailed them. His approval itself is very similar. 45% this time around. It was about that last time. But the disapproval is what jumped. It's up to 49% now, and he's underwater in his job approval, which is the first time that we've seen that. So you'd have to think that it's been a tough year for the mayor, what with JEA and some of the concerns about transparency, and also, you know, he's gotten a lot of pushback lately on opening up too quickly after corona, and all of this, I think, has led to him being in this position.
And that gets to a deeper trend that you're finding in Duval County. Duval County has trended purple politically in recent years. You polled on the upcoming 2020 election. 48% of voters in Duval say they'll support Joe Biden. Just 41% say they'll vote for Donald Trump. That's more of a lean toward Biden than people might have thought would happen in this county. Tell us more about that.
Well, I think there's a few things going on. One, Donald Trump has really just struggled the last several months nationally, both handling issues around the coronavirus, handling the issues that have sprung from the George Floyd death and all those protests. And you're seeing that reflected. But also something people need to understand about Duval County. Yeah, we've been trending purple. But in 2016, our voter registration, Democrats had a three-point registration advantage. And on Election Day, that turned out to Republicans having about a 1% advantage in turnout. Well, in 2020, at this point, and we still have several months to go, Democrats are plus 6 in registration. So that's an even harder jump for Republicans to get if they want to turn out in greater numbers. I think that our county's turning purple and ultimately will be turning blue at some point.
We're talking with UNF pollster Mike Binder. Let us know where you stand on the Republican National Convention coming this summer and other issues we're discussing. It's 549-2937. Now, you also polled on a big local issue, whether voters are for or against a half-cent sales tax increase to support school repair and construction. 70% say they will vote for this tax, even in the recession that we're now in. So that's showing a deep well of support, Mike.
Yeah, and that's just something we posted the numbers for both registered voters as well as a version of likely voters, which was reflective of a 2016 turnout model, which has more Republicans than I probably would expect to see actually in 2020. And support really didn't change much, 69, 70%. And there's support across the board. Democrats are overwhelmingly supportive. NPAs are overwhelmingly supportive. But Republicans are even supportive. And males, females, black, white, Hispanics, young, old, everywhere across the board, people are over 50% on this, and in some cases much, much higher than that.
All right.
I think this is an issue that's really played across the county entirely.
So we're going to take the pulse of our listeners right now. You can express yourself by giving us a call as we speak with Mike Binder. He runs UNF's Public Opinion Research Lab. And a new poll out today from the school shows that the majority of voters in Duval County oppose the Republican National Convention coming here in August. Many of you out there are concerned about coronavirus spread. Protests. What do you think about all this? It's time to give us a call at 549-2937. Megan is in San Marco. Hi, Megan. How are you?
Hi. Good morning.
Good morning.
Hi. I just heard your poll. I'm just getting off work. I'm a nurse. I work at one of the local hospitals.
Uh-huh.
And I just see this convention coming here as just, I don't know if it's unaware, like it's a startling lack of awareness, or if it's just a complete disregard for the safety and security of people, or it's misinterpreting where we are in this pandemic. But I feel like a lot of more conservative people that I've met here in Jacksonville seem to think that the coronavirus pandemic is over.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we can see from the trends that it's not.
It's not. And Megan, tell us how it's going at your hospital with COVID patients. What are you seeing and hearing there?
At my hospital in particular, I don't want to say which one it is specifically, but at my hospital in particular, they're doing a very good job of triaging in the emergency department. So they've kept a lot of patients that would have come to our ICU. Usually they're keeping them out of our ICU so that we have plenty of ICU beds if we get more COVID patients.
Well, that's good. So what we're hearing then about ICU beds filling up in local hospitals around this community, they're not at capacity yet then, right?
At least in my hospital, they are not. I can't speak to other people's hospitals, but of course I'm very concerned, especially because, a lot of the people that I've talked to about seeming to feel like we've been trending down and that the coronavirus pandemic is over have been younger people. And now we're seeing a spike in positive cases from younger people.
Right. That has been worrisome to see, Megan. I want to thank you for the call. That's Megan. She's a nurse in Jacksonville. Thanks for that, Megan. Mike Binder, whether it was the president's recent rally in Tulsa or whether it's the Republican National Convention coming here in August, both public health officials in Oklahoma and here in Florida have begged politicians not to put on these large-scale closed-door events where you have thousands of people inside an arena without masks, without social distancing, without any way to limit the spread. So we are hearing loudly from nurses, doctors, public health officials that these events are simply not safe and not good for public health. And that's coming through in your polling, too, amongst the general public.
Yeah, absolutely. And listen, this is something that you're beginning to see a partisan divide on. And when we did this poll back in April, it wasn't nearly as strong as it is today. And the caller is correct, right? Republicans and conservatives are thinking that this is less and less of a problem, as well as younger folks. And what we're beginning to see is younger folks testing positive. Obviously, the last week or so, everything has been going on at the beaches, at the beach bars. We've seen big spikes in positive cases. And now we are going to potentially be seeing this very large convention with, you know, upwards of 10,000 people crammed in this tiny little arena, yelling and screaming with no masks. All it takes is just a couple of people to be positive and asymptomatic to be able to spread that to really, really big numbers. And it's concerning, certainly.
And you said this is certainly seen through a partisan lens. Talk a little bit more about that, what your research shows on that. Because, you know, theoretically, public health information shouldn't be partisan, but most things in our American life today are.
Sadly, they are. So, for example, we asked, you know, how concerned are you about the coronavirus pandemic in general? Democrats, 93% are either somewhat or very concerned. Republicans, 63%. We asked folks, you know, how concerned are you personally about contracting the coronavirus? Democrats, 82%. Republicans, 47%. I mean, these are striking gaps in partisanship levels of concern. And these are issues that, you know, we really need to think about. Even, you know, do you know anybody that's personally tested positive? Democrats, 44%. Republicans, only 26%. Now, this isn't something that is if this is not directly affecting your life, it's easy for me to see how somebody might think, oh, everything's getting open, we're back to normal, we waited our 2 weeks, our 2 months like we were supposed to wait, everything's fine. But no, there are some big gaps, and a lot of this plays into not only your underlying political ideology about how the world works and individuality, but also the information that you're taking in as well can play into that.
Right, where you're getting your news. And certainly, if you're a Republican and you support President Trump, you're more ideologically inclined to take cues from him. If we had a Democratic president right now, we might see the flip of this in your polling. We might be hearing Republicans saying, this is a huge problem, you know, if the situation were reversed.
Certainly. And we're even seeing this when we ask about, you know, people opening up in Jacksonville too quickly. 86% of Democrats think we're opening up too quickly, but only 20% of Republicans think we're opening up too quickly. In fact, 22% think we're opening up too slowly.
Let's go to a few more calls now for UNF's Mike Binder. Jimmy in Riverside. Hi, Jimmy.
Hey, how are you this
morning? Good, thanks. Go ahead.
I'm calling because it appears to me that Republicans do not believe in science, and their behaviors show as such. The president doesn't wear a mask, and this is the case with the virus as well as global warming. Last week, it was 100 degrees in Siberia. Like, we need leadership that's going to take into account the science. There's no way that there should be a convention being held. The city, the state, the country was opened up too soon, and it was because of economics. It had nothing to do with public safety, and citizens are paying attention to this, and they're not paying attention to the virus, and we are in deep trouble. Thank you for taking my call.
Thanks, Jimmy. The perception that conservatives, Republicans, Mike, are hostile to science. What are your thoughts about that as someone who studies political data and how people interpret it, interpret science, interpret information?
Well, I certainly think that in looking at how this is playing out, one could make that argument. However, I will caution that there is another side to this too, because this isn't just about public health, and it's also about the economic impact that the measures that public health safety requires have taken. And that's another angle that really needs to be considered, and we are concerned and we're worried about that. Kind of bringing it back to the data that we're releasing, when we ask folks about how concerned are they about coronavirus impacting the economy, everybody's concerned. 75-80%, both Republicans and Democrats, are concerned about the economic impact. But the difference comes when we ask about what's a bigger concern, public health or economics. Democrats, 82%, think it's public health. Republicans, 69%, think it's the economic impact. So if you think the economic threat is larger to you than necessarily either contracting coronavirus or the public health impact of coronavirus, you're going to want to continue on with life as normal. And by normal, I mean, pre-March, to get the economy going again, because you think that's a bigger threat. And I can understand where people come from if they believe that.
Mm. Brian in Atlantic Beach. Hi, Brian. Go ahead. What do you think?
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I just want to mention that I believe that this RNC convention, it would be nice if there was a purpose behind it, if there was a contended candidacy for the president, for the Republican nomination. But in reality, it's just a giant Trump rally with people coming in from all over the country. And to know, for President Trump and the RNC to know that what's on Americans' minds is the spread of coronavirus, and for the science to say that people coming in from all over the country is a bad thing for it, I think it's irresponsible, and I disagree with it.
Thanks, Brian. I it's pretty clear where people are, Mike, in this community. And of course, we got the convention because North Carolina said, no, we won't allow you to hold a big event that could spread the virus. Now, all of that said, it is 2 months away. We don't know yet where we'll be with the spread of coronavirus in 2 months. There's still a lot to watch for when we look at what could be happening with this later in the year. Do you think that they might have trouble packing ViStar Arena, given these worries and apprehensions people have?
Ultimately, I suspect not, mostly because this is a national convention, and while there may not be an undecided outcome to who's ultimately going to get the nomination, like the caller was discussing, this is a ginormous television show event. And for several days, the nation is glued to the TV, watching and learning about not only the nominee, but other members of the party, and getting a sense about what that party's policies and positions are going forward for the next election. So there is certainly an educative effect to these glorified television shows. ViStar, while a very nice arena, is not the Jaguar Stadium, right? You don't need 60,000 people to fill it. I think you can easily get, 15,000 people downtown Jacksonville from across the country, mind you, that are going to be willing to come down here and show up and go to this thing.
Bill tweets the show, I completely reject Mayor Curry's advice on COVID-19. The same applies to Governor DeSantis and President Trump. I'm not trusting my health and safety to any of these three. I hope others feel the same way, he says. On our Facebook page, Jeanette writes, I don't see a point in having a convention this year for all the reasons stated and because we know who the candidates are. Well, Mike, that would go for Milwaukee, too. There's opposition in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, sure, to having the Democratic convention held there where they coronate Joe Biden.
Absolutely. I mean, there hasn't been reason for a convention in 40 years, longer, really, 60 years. These conventions are pro forma. They're glorified TV shows. There is no uncertainty about who the nominee is going to be. But that's what they're there for. They're big, giant rallies for the parties to get the bases excited and also to inform some folks about what some of these policies might be. But you're right. We're a long ways off from August. We're a long ways off from Milwaukee. We don't know what the state of the world is going to be at that time. And these are all things that, we as voters and, citizens have begun to really understand that tomorrow is very uncertain. Certainly the last couple months have not played out like anybody would have imagined just in February.
Sure. I mean, we saw these huge protests over the killing of George Floyd and a push to end systemic racism in our culture and in policing. You even found in your polling in Jacksonville, which has tended to lean much more conservative in the past over issues involving racism and law enforcement, you found a majority of Jacksonville voters believe the deaths of Black people during encounters with police are signs of a broader problem with systemic racism. They overwhelmingly support nonviolent demonstrations. That was an interesting data point, too.
Yeah, the level of support both for the protests among both Democrats, but even Republicans, was really interesting to us that we found. And unsurprisingly, right, you would expect that Democrats might be more supportive of this, and they were, 96%. But even Republicans, 63%, either strongly or somewhat support the nonviolent protest. So I think that says a lot. And you know, how this plays into the role that, you know, Jacksonville has with the relationship between the city and the police department, I think there were some more numbers there that were a little bit unnerving. And that's something to think about. You know, we asked folks if they think that the deaths of Black people during encounters with police are either, you know, a result of isolated incidents or broader systemic racism. Democrats, 91% broader systemic racism. Republicans, 80% isolated incidents. Hmm. Right. So there's big partisan splits there. But the racial splits are really striking, too. 44% of white people think it's a sign of broader problems of systemic racism, 89% of Black folks. And these are, this is something that, listen, whether or not the convention comes here, is kind of out of our hands. And even if it comes and coronavirus spreads, it's a relatively short-term problem. If there are real systemic problems of trust between the police and the community, these are issues that threaten Jacksonville long term, and I don't have a quick fix answer for it. I certainly don't think anybody else does, but that's something that's very worrisome.
It is always insightful, though, to get your polling, because you do such a good job of taking snapshots of this community and really the whole state. If you're just tuning in, lots of feedback this morning on the show for UNF pollster Mike Binder. Here's an email for you, Mike, from Mark in Fernandina Beach. He just asked, if I heard the data correctly, it sounds like Republicans are only half as likely to know someone who has COVID as Democrats. Why such a discrepancy? Does race have anything to do with it? Because more people of color are getting the virus than whites. What about that? You said a minute ago, more Democrats than Republicans say, I know someone who's been sick with COVID.
Right. And so let's take a look. We have all of these things broken out, which is kind of nice. If you take a look at our website, you can go to the press release and see everything broken out by all the various demographics. And so if we ask people, you know, do you know somebody? Actually, more white folks than Black folks know somebody more Black folks than white folks have known somebody, but it's not by much. It's 40% to 31%. So certainly there's a little bit of a race component there, but it's not gigantic. The real issue is age. And ironically, the concerns are the plus 65s, the older folks. Those are the folks that are least likely to know somebody. Only 28% of the over 65s know somebody who's contracted it, compared to the 18 to 24s, where it's 42% have known somebody that contracted it. So I think that's really where you're seeing your differentiation, because partisanship and age are correlated so highly.
Okay, so as we've gone through a wealth of data here, what's your final takeaway for the listeners out there? Because we are certainly in an interesting time in Jacksonville right now.
We're in a really interesting time. I think the one thing that struck me about this is the level of participation that we've received. Over 2,500 Jacksonville voters responded to this survey. These are issues that are of vital importance, both health and safety and public safety. People care about them. They have strong opinions about them. A lot of times when we ask about issues, you see a bunch of folks in the middle, the somewhat approved, the somewhat disapproved. We saw a lot of folks on the polar opposite, strongly approve or strongly disapprove. People care. People have opinions, and people are worried about these issues. And these are things that our elected officials, I think, need to be paying attention to.
I really appreciate you, as always, appearing on the show. We'll have more on the poll on our website today. You can also check it out at UNF's website. He's UNF pollster Mike Bender runs the school's public opinion research lab. Thanks, Mike.
Thanks for having me, Melissa.
Much more still ahead. Later, it's the launch of our What's Good Wednesdays, finding good news in this pandemic and recession. And up next.
Honestly, when it came to deciding what story to post, I couldn't figure out which one to share because it's so many things that I experienced.
Former students share their experiences online about being Black at Bowles. That's next.
Electro Lounge can now be heard Monday through Fridays at 10 p.m. till midnight and Saturdays from 9 to 11. Join us at the Electro Lounge only on 89.9 WJCT.
As the coronavirus pandemic continues, many children are suffering from confusion, stress, and loneliness. And some are reverting to behavior they've outgrown.
Carter, who hasn't been rocked to sleep in a while, wanted to sit in my lap and be rocked in the chair that I used to breastfeed him in.
I'm Sarah McCammon, how parents can help their children and teens cope on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Electro Lounge can now be heard 24 hours a day, 7 days a week on WJCT 89.9 HD4 Electro Lounge Radio or on the WJCT app. Electro Lounge Radio, part of the Jacksonville Music Experience.
Welcome back. Well, students and graduates at a number of various schools have been taking to social media lately to share stories of what they say are issues of systemic racism within these academic institutions. One of these accounts is an anonymous space for kids from Bowles, the elite private Jacksonville day and boarding school. The Black at Bowles Instagram account shares stories of racist incidents on campus. And it also has issued a list of demands for school administrators, including firing some faculty members, banning display of the Confederate flag, hiring a more diverse bench of faculty and staff, and ending a prohibition on African-American hairstyles on campus, like braids or dreadlocks. Lots to digest there. I learned more about the Black at Bowles Instagram page from Mahia Lawson, a recent Bowles graduate. Take a listen. Mahia Lawson, good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you, too.
Now, you graduated from Bowles. You're in college now, but you have posted on this Instagram page, Black at Bowles. It's an anonymous space for students, parents, faculty, and staff to share their experiences about attending Bowles as a person of color or teaching there. Tell me a little bit about the comments that you're seeing on this page and why you decided to share a post, too.
I found out about the page very recently. I want to say this past weekend. Honestly, when it came to deciding what story to post, I couldn't figure out which one to share because it's so many that you... It's so many things that I experienced that I didn't know what to start.
Hard to pick just one. What story did you decide to share?
It was a post that was about, well, the story I shared was with another student. Soon, about a week after we graduated high school, he went on Snapchat and posted a video of him saying the N-word, and I commented on it. And he didn't take it too lightly, but I tried to have a conversation with him explaining why he should not say it or why he shouldn't have said it. But he disagreed the whole time and wasn't really willing to understand where I was coming from, which then turned into him making another post directly verbally attacking me, degrading me, saying I was stupid, ignorant, couldn't tell him anything. And he made a bunch more comments just about Black people being entitled or feeling like we're entitled to everything and how our struggles don't compare to his. But I felt like it was important for other people who were still maybe in contact with him to also understand the type of person he is.
Yeah. And so when I scroll through Black at Bowles on Instagram, there are a lot of posts that are eye-popping, to say the least.
where anonymous students, current and former, and sometimes parents and faculty share their stories. Here's one that was recently posted from the class of 2017. And they say, I was hanging out with some old Bulls friends, and they told me about some of the crazy stuff some of the older football coaches would say to them in practice. One said they called one of the dark-skinned players Shadow and joked about how they couldn't see them at night. I know this sounds fake, but it's real, and I was legit shocked when they told me. I know they had no choice but to just go with it because the whole coaching staff is all white males. The school needs to do so much better with diversity in the faculty and in athletics. And that's a common theme here on these posts. Have you heard at all, or have any of your friends heard, from the Bulls administration about this Instagram account and the feedback that students and some faculty and parents are giving?
No, they sent out an email yesterday basically explaining how they are going to be working to include African-American history into their curriculum now. But I also reached out to two of the faculty members that I'm really close with. I reached out to them to check on to see how they were doing with everything that was coming about since they're going to be over bringing that change to the school. And it seems to be as if the school is really genuine right now, but I feel like, honestly, the school has been had the chance to do something about it, but is now at a point where they can't just ignore it, and so they are going to decide to do something about it. Because when I was there, I was president of the Black Student Union, and we had situations that occurred, and we brought it to administrative attention, but yet they did the minimum. They will maybe give a student a lunch duty for it. And now lunch duty is something that I would get if my skirt was too short, I get a lunch duty. And you're telling me that a student who's being blatantly racist is going to get that same consequence? So it's interesting to see how they are deciding to go about it now. But it's hard for me to trust that it's going to be something that's continuous or actually progressive at the school.
And whether it's Bulls or any other school or institution, this is something that organizations are dealing with all over America right now. So in that sense, Bulls is just one example out of many, right?
Yes, but it also gives us, it puts America on a smaller scale. Like, this isn't just happening at Bulls or at another school in Jacksonville. This is America. Like, it's happening in America because you have people who come from privilege that's at higher up, that have higher positions in life. And they're doing the same thing. Like, it's not just this one place or one area. So I think it shows a lot about our current society and how things are going for us now.
Well, Mahia Lawson, I want to thank you for sharing your thoughts about this. She's a Bulls graduate, and the Instagram account is Black at Bulls. Mahia, thanks.
Thank you.
Now, we reached out to the Bulls School Administration for comment, and we haven't heard back from them just yet. Well, it's a gorgeous new book featuring the dishes and stories of more than 100 African-American chefs, including one from Jacksonville. Tokes in Black, A Celebration of Black Chefs by Alan Batts, profiles 101 culinary standouts of color from around the country. We're so pleased to welcome Alan Batts. He's on the line now. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm great. Also with us, Jacksonville chef DeJuan Roy of the Alhambra Theater, featured in the book. Chef DeJuan, good morning to you.
Good morning. How are you guys doing?
Great. It's so good to have you both on the show. Alan, let's start with you. You're a food photographer known as Batman because of your last name.
Since I was a kid.
Yeah. How did you come up with this concept for profiling 101 black chefs across America?
Well, actually, I didn't think there were 101 black chefs when I first started. I had done a French MasterChef book, I'll talk real quick, and it was 77 chefs around the country, and it was really kind of the best project that I've ever had. I usually do work in New York. And so after I did that, I was thinking, well, what else could I do? And I knew a couple of black chefs in New York, and not that many, and I thought, well, gee, maybe I should do that. Maybe I could bring something to light that hasn't been, you know, talked about very much. And so it was all word of mouth, and I thought I wasn't going to have enough to fill up one book, and it ended up I had more than I know what to do with, so we cut it off at 101.
101, and that includes Chef DeJuan Roy of the Alhambra Theater. Chef DeJuan, tell us about your cooking and how it's spotlighted in this book.
So, obviously I'm out at the Alhambra Historical Dinner Theater, and I've been out there about 9 years or so. So we were able to kind of blow life back into that theater and bring some excitement back to the dining scene. So contemporary, upscale Floridian, try to use, local ingredients, source responsibly and that sort of thing. And just, just trying to cook, purposefully and meaningfully. And it seems to have been working so far. So that's kind of like my style of cooking.
That's so cool. And it will be so great for people to check this out. Because, Alan, whether it's Chef DeJuan or any of these other chefs you profile, roots in the African diaspora are reflected in the cuisines that they create. Can you talk a little bit more about how these folkways have moved into the food that these chefs are so skilled at preparing?
Well, first, everybody doesn't do Southern food or African food. It's a lot of the chefs did a combination, a fusion.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the book spotlights the diversity of the chefs, which is what I wanted, in particular, and not just the diaspora. And I think it does that. And I think they're happy to let people know that they can do anything and everything. So that's where it came from. But I wasn't looking for anything in particular, a specific cuisine. I really wanted to show the diversity of the group of chefs.
Right. And Chef DeJuan, that's what's cool about this, because there are chefs profiled all across the country. There's really amazing culinary talent in just about any city in America you go to, right?
Absolutely. And the last couple of years, I've been dabbling around myself with a good friend of mine, Erica Klein, trying to, get as many African-American or brown chefs together to kind of see, exactly how diverse we were. And we've been able to meet in some pretty cool places. A couple years back, we were in the British Virgin Islands, Tortola, and it might have been about 20 of us. And you talk about 20 different cooks with 20 different palates, and these African-American chefs were from all over the United States, actually all over the world. And so it was really neat to work with Alan, pulling together 101 black chefs. Like Alan was saying earlier, I didn't know that there were that many. I know there's not that many here in Jax. So it's been really cool, like Alan said, to see the diversity and and to be a part of this book. It's been great.
So, Alan, you found 101 amazing chefs, more than you expected. What are some of the barriers that you see in the food business, the culinary world, for a young person of color who is interested in that, to pursuing that as a livelihood?
What would make it easier or what makes it difficult?
I guess both.
I think just getting the word out. People don't know. When I first started in New York, I think I knew three. And I had started the first, I think, 10 chefs. I asked them to do two dishes because I didn't think I'd have enough to fill up a book. And then just talking it and, with everybody and asking, who do you know? And then asking that person, who do you know? And I ended up with all these chefs. And we started having this. I have an event that I have every year. It's called the Great Gathering of Chefs. And it was mostly chefs from New York, I had 200 chefs in each book. And so we started 2 weeks ago having the Great Gathering of Black Chefs on Zoom, and we do 25 at a time. And they were all so happy to see people that look like they do. And most of them, they didn't know each other. So it's been a wonderful, the best adventure I ever had.
That's so great. And not only are you doing that, because of the COVID pandemic, you couldn't really promote this book in the traditional way. So you came up with something called Kitchen Sessions. How is that coming together?
It's coming. That was Scott Barton, who's one of the chefs in there. That was his idea. I think it's a great idea. It's coming. Logistically, it's kind of difficult, but it's getting better every week. Using two chefs from the book and one showing the other one how to do something that they might not know how to do or collaborating on a particular dish. So it's been really interesting. And what I'd like to do from the sale of the book, it's a long story. I think we only have 4 minutes left.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Go ahead.
So anyway, originally it was, I have a class that I give that teaches unemployed Black and Hispanics how to work in the kitchen. It's free. And then we got jobs. Right now there aren't any jobs. So I'd like to take that money to promote this cooking classes and just a dialogue about Black, you know, with Black chefs and other colors. So that's where it's at. We just like to make it better and bigger and wonderful.
Now here's a tweet from Teresa. She says, "We love Chef Duan's meals at the Alhambra Theater. My personal favorite is the fried chicken with the Alabama white BBQ sauce. Yum." So you got a lot of fans out there, Chef Duan, and your fan base will only increase with the publication of this book. What's it been like at the Alhambra getting through the pandemic and trying to figure out a business model and then looking at reopening as well?
Yeah, it's been very interesting. Thanks for asking. Obviously, the first week that COVID hit pretty hard, we shut down for a few days and just, you know, cleaned the place like crazy. And, you know, it was so much uncertainty. And then, you know, after speaking with Craig, I said, well, listen, let's kick in some to-go orders. People can swing by the front of the theater and get the food. And wow, we were, fortunate. It was wildly successful, and people were very, you know, receptive to that. So that kept us busy and actually very busy for the last 8 weeks or so. But then as the state of Florida started to reopen over these last few weeks, that to-go order kind of slowed down. But we are open and have shows in there at 50% capacity. And one thing about the theater was we have the luxury of space, so we can spread people out safely, and we put up some plexiglass in the theater, and obviously everybody is wearing glove and mask. So that's been going pretty well thus far.
That is so great to hear. And I think, you know, it's a time when people really are seeking to connect over a great meal, now more than ever. So check out the new book, Toques in Black, featuring the talents of 101 Black chefs from across America. One of them is Chef Duan Roy of the Alhambra Theater. Alan the Batman, as he's known, and Chef Duan, thank you both so much for sharing this with our listeners. And check out the details on Toques in Black Kitchen Sessions on Eventbrite, too. Thanks, guys, so much. Have a great day.
Well thank you, and you too.
And in a moment, we're sharing some more good news this week with the launch of our What's Good Wednesday. That's after this.
One Florida Clinical Research Consortium invites essential workers in healthcare to join the HERO Registry and share how the COVID-19 pandemic has impacted their lives with researchers from the University of Florida and nationwide. Clinical and non-clinical personnel can register online to tell their story at heroesresearch.org, because the best way to thank healthcare heroes is to learn from them.
As the coronavirus pandemic continues, many children are suffering from confusion, stress, and loneliness, and some are reverting to behavior they've outgrown.
Carter, who hasn't been rocked to sleep in a while, wanted to sit in my lap and be rocked in the chair that I used to breastfeed him in.
I'm Sarah McCammon, how parents can help their children and teens cope on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Pastry chef Paola Velez was nominated for a prestigious James Beard Award. She brings her Dominican heritage into her baking and has a message for young chefs of color.
Make sure that you keep your head high and know that eventually people will see you, because I wish that somebody told me that when I was in the industry at first too.
That's next time on Here and Now.
This afternoon at 1 on 89.9 WJCT.
Racism has shaped America in ways big and small. Ripping up a statue is one thing, but what about changing a logo or naming a sports team or getting rid of a song or a phrase? If racism is at the root of so many things, how do we pull it out? How to reckon with our past so we can get on with our future? Next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back and happy Wednesday. Yeah, it's the midpoint in the week. And we're starting a new tradition here on this so-called hump day as we kick off our first ever weekly newsletter today on the show. Yeah, look for fresh, sparkling midweek updates and ramblings from myself and producer Heather Schatz every Wednesday afternoon with our brand new What's Good Wednesdays e-newsletter. This is interesting, cool, and positive stuff that catches our eye each week that we want to give to you, the community. And you can sign up for this free e-newsletter right on our website at WJCT.org. So what's good, you might ask, in this time of pandemic and recession? There's a lot, actually, it turns out. Right now, I'm going to take you through a few items that caught our eye this week, beginning with spaceflight right here in Northeast Florida. You can read this story on our website. A private company is going to launch tourists to the edge of space from Florida using a hydrogen-filled balloon as early as next year. And they might be doing it, they say, from Cecil Spaceport in Jacksonville, either there or Kennedy Space Center. This company, Space Perspective, is going to launch a capsule with 8 passengers and 1 pilot to the edge of space and cruise through the stratosphere. This is a 6-hour flight straight up about 100,000 feet. Now, if you have $125,000, you can buy a ticket and you could potentially launch, as I said, from Cecil Spaceport. Pretty cool. All right, here's one. Captain Sandy Yon from Bravo TV's Below Deck Mediterranean. She recently bought a 106-year-old firehouse in downtown Jacksonville, and she's going to convert it into a rooftop bar and restaurant, activating an historic building in the city's urban core. Follow that one. And we talked about cooking in the previous segment. This is neat. Chef Ernest Hopkins of the Jacksonville Jumbo Shrimp is teaching a live, interactive virtual cooking class Friday night at 6:30 p.m. He's teaming up with Major League Baseball and NFL legend Bo Jackson. They're going to make Bo's 34 steaks with steak sliders and home-fried kettle potatoes. You can sign up for this. It's $60 a person. Go to jackshrimp.org. Wolfson Children's Hospital is giving out free child-sized face masks. Yeah, up to 3 per household. Visit the link on our website to register to receive those. And speaking of the pandemic, many small businesses have had to move their operations online. If you need help with navigating this new digital workplace we all now call home, there is some out there. The company Control Alt Digital is offering up to 2 hours of donated website assistance from now until the end of July. And they're prioritizing Black-owned businesses too. If you're accepted, you can get technical guidance, consulting, and even hands-on development work. That's a very nice free opportunity. Here's something else you need to log on to. You can get into full downward dog mode at the first ever Yoga for Change live virtual art show. That's coming up Tuesday, June 30th, next week, 7 o'clock at night. And the event will showcase one piece of artwork from 10 local Jacksonville artists. These artists have priced their own artwork for sale. A portion of the proceeds will go toward Yoga for Change, and they can be shipped anywhere. Now, Yoga for Change is a great local organization, and they bring the therapeutic power of yoga to veterans, the incarcerated, people living with mental health conditions. In other words, they are the embodiment of what's good. So this is just a sampling of what we're sending out in our What's Good Wednesday e-blast later on today. If you need some good news in your life, just go to our website at wjct.org and sign up for What's Good Wednesdays, where we take a look at the people and organizations all across the First Coast trying to do some good things in this pandemic and recession. Again, that's at wjct.org. And if you have some good news that you'd like us to put on our weekly menu, send it to us at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And happy Wednesday, everybody. Thanks so much for listening to this show, and thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Josh Torres is our show director. The station news director here at WJCT is Jessica Palumbo. Our digital editor is Bill Bortsfield. As I said, we value your feedback. Keep those emails coming to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And if you missed any portion of today's show, catch our rebroadcast tonight at 8 o'clock or catch our podcast online later today. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect on 89.9. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Again, our first ever e-blast for What's Good Wednesdays goes out later today. If you want to be an early adopter and one of our first subscribers, we've already got dozens of you signed up. Sign up for free at wjct.org and be part of this community. Have a great day, everybody, and keep wearing your masks.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.